in the immediate. As far as the money goes, because there was this ask doesn't mean there will be the money. We're going to know where the legislative session started yesterday. Tomorrow at 8 o'clock is the first hearing on the task force recommendations, and we'll start hearing more about that down the road. And there are the existing work groups associated with the task force. From the impression I got, a lot of that work from the work groups will then transfer sort of over into some of the PSEM work. And so as far as the implementation on killer whale, we may be looking at this stuff evolving over the next 3 years and doing that. And the issue of all the pinnipeds, I know that, you know, there's evaluation. And there's a strong effort. There is Canadian representation on the task force. There's an effort to have more both transboundary work and transboundary indicators developed. So in the short term, I don't know if there's an answer to how we're going to do things. After the session is over, we'll know a lot more about the budget. But exactly where the role is for us is questionable. But we have a lot of other mandates, too. You know, the whole status of all marine mammals, I think, is an important issue. But anyway, that's just the perspective I got today. And just one other perspective. This came from the science panel saying they're looking now, they were having some problems defining exactly where they were prioritizing. And they're now looking more at PSEMP to handle a lot of the data parts. And then they will work more on the science / policy interface, so that they're going to lean more on us for a lot of the data stuff. So that's another evolving aspect within the work group. Again, not short term. Okay.
I would add, you know, sort of to your transboundary point, Steve, I did try to invite those colleagues who I think would be well positioned to help coordinate particularly monitoring information that then could feed into consistent policies on both sides of the border. So John Ford has said he's interested in participating. He had a last-minute conflict today. I also invited Lance Barrett-Leonard, and Andrew Trites was on the beginning of the call. So I think there are a few other DFO folks that we could reach out to, like Eddie, to try to keep facilitating that. But part of the reason I'm here is I coordinate Hydrophone Network, and there's a huge investment going into whale tracking, mostly southern residents, but also other species using the much more extensive hydrophone networks in Canada. So I think there's going to be a technological convergence of new websites where we can surface and manage data, and then a bunch of new data sources coming, at least from the bioacoustic research realm, monitoring.
Yeah, this is Ken. Could I just interject some information?
Please.
Yeah, okay. For the benefit of those on this call, I really would like to just remove some uncertainty. This new baby that was just born to L77 was at least several weeks old, so it was born prior to the end of 2018. So we're counting 75 southern residents as of December 31st. And we know that because we've seen them all since then, so that's a number that's worthwhile. And we know that in the last 10 years, we've had 16 male babies born and 7 females. That's anomalous. Something is going on with the gender issue. We know that we've got over 250 transient whales that episodically come through this area. And their reproduction is doing just fine. I'll be putting on our website, whaleresearch.com, all of our information on the genders of babies and when, et cetera. But, you know, we just want to emphasize that there is certainty in this top predator population. So the rest of it has to be worked out as to what to do. But obviously, and you've heard me say it many times, they need food. The idea of culling the food for transients is interesting, but as usual, human interjection into these things is likely to backfire or end up in unexpected results, sometimes unpleasant, as in the case of Southern residents. Anyway, we know a lot about it. The question is the political motivation to do anything. And I appreciate this call. I can't do many of them, but I'm glad that we have colleagues that now at least have some certainty that I hope you will relate to whatever your organizational interests are and the state. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. That's actually a perfect segue into what I would like to do next. My favorite part of participating in these meetings over the years has been just sharing information about the ecosystem. So I wanted to invite everybody to take a few minutes, 2, 3, maybe 5, if you've got a lot to say, and just introduce yourself, let us know where you're calling from and your affiliation. And then if you'd like to share a highlight from 2018 related to any marine mammal or any recent updates on your projects or work, like what Ken just provided, feel free. Before we start, can I ask, are there any new people on the call?
All right. Val Beers is on the call now.
Well, welcome, Val. So, let's see, why don't we, Ken, I guess, Ken and John and Steve and Pete, you guys have been on the working group for a long time, so why don't we start with you, and we'll work up to the folks who are here for their first meeting. Ken, do you want to add anything else to what you already said?
No, that was the summary. Our website, whaleresearch.com, I try and write it out and put it out for all of the peers and the public and the media. And, of course, that is getting some coverage at present. But I'm going to have to duck out. I hope that you will provide some summary of what everybody has to say. I've got a roof that's uncovered that we have to cover before the rains start tomorrow night. So I got to really go. But I thank you all.
Well, you know me, Ken. I'm recording this, so I'll send you the MP3.
Thank you.
Hey, Ken, Steve Jeffries.
Yes, Steve.
One of the things we talked about this new Puget Sound Marine Waters report, and there's a section in here on marine mammal trends or whatever, and there's nothing in there. There's very little in there. You have to dig to see it. I would suggest, although we know the killer whale story and the count stuff, this document would actually be a good spot to just put the killer whale story in this. If we do more of these, at least the killer whale updates, it's a really good spot so everybody sees it. We all know it, but
yeah. Breaking news, the workshop to set the stage for the next report is going to be on May 1st. So, and we did talk about this at the steering committee meeting. Scott was there about, so there's definitely an open invitation and encouragement to capture those trends from marine mammals in here. And just so you guys know, the history of this report is it really started from the Marine Waters Group and was totally focused on sort of the oceanographic factors and things, and it's been recently just as a factor of who shows up to the workshop and who contributes to the report as to what gets in there. So we can opportunistically get more in there for this year and think longer term about the vision for this report and a bigger, maybe even a differently aimed PSEM report moving forward as well, and how we communicate for what kinds of objectives. That's a big focus moving forward.
And just another note is that the biennial State of the Sound report has the has a section on the Southern Resident Killer Whale because it's a vital sign. So there is that publication, but that's not, these reach different audiences, and I think it would be a very good idea to have the Reed Waters report include the Southern Western Kiowa.
So, Ken, I mean, your data get essentially distilled into the vital sign, but would you be willing to have the center provide a graph, something like what Jane Cogan has been putting together, and make sure that the whaleresearch.com URL gets in here?
Yes, surely. Just send me the address of who to send it to, and it'll be done.
All right.
And you can send it to either me personally, Ken Balcom, at Gmail, or the info at Whale Research, and we'll get it to you.
Okay. That'll happen in the next couple of months, so I can facilitate that.
Okay. Thank you much, and sorry I do have to go, because I got guys out front ready to put tar paper on. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Yep.
How about, let's see, Steve, do you want to go next?
Sure.
Sure, I'll be glad to go.
Pete, yeah, all right.
Did you say Pete or Steve? Go ahead, Steve, I'm sorry.
It's okay. I work for Fish and Wildlife, and, you know, we've been heavily involved in the task force and the discussions about, you know, to cull or not to cull or transit, you know, what's the effect. And I think if people haven't seen the we did a presentation to the commission, I think on the 12th of December, and I think you can find the link to it. And I think the short answer to cull or not to cull is we basically said it's not going to make much of a difference if you culled a bunch of seals I'm giving the short summary, but you know there are better options. That's low hanging fruit. You know, there's better options to making more salmon, but I don't know exactly what they are. But it's, you know, killing pinnipeds to save salmon is probably not the solution to the problem. I do think that Puget Sound, the Salish Sea, is sick, you know, and it needs repair. I mean, it's not just seals. I mean, I think if you look at this report, this marine waters report, and the data that they have, that 15-year trend data, it looks like harbor seal numbers are decreasing. And actually, that's what we are seeing. So we're actually, whether it's transients or whatever, we're actually having, you know, if the transients are truly culling 1,000 animals a year, they're reducing the population, and eventually it will get reduced to the point where their impact on, you know, Chinook salmon is not going to be as big as it is, if it's even significant at this point. But anyway, we're, you know, the thing that we struggle with is marine mammals used to be a PSAMP priority species. Harbor seals were the indicator species. I see it's up here in an agenda item. We got funding for the first 7 or 8 years when the partner, or the Puget Sound, what was it, Puget Sound Ambient, PSAMP was the original PSAMP program. And once that program kind of was not a indicator species anymore, we haven't done surveys. Nobody's doing surveys. So we did a survey in 2014, but nobody's really doing surveys for trends for harbor seals. It should be done, particularly if we're talking about manning them into the future. But anyway, we're just, like I say, we've been working on, you know, sea lions in the Columbia River, which is a high priority for us. It's the same, you know, pinniped interactions with salmon, and what do we do with that? So that's what I spend most of my time on now. But I'll stop there.
How about you, Pete? You want to give us any highlights or news?
I can give you some highlights and maybe some news and maybe even a suggestion or two. First, I forget it, is to write down the name Stephen Rafferty. I met Steve about 17 years ago, and he exclaimed how important he thinks it is to do transboundary work. We were doing a necropsy on an orca that's stranded at the mouth of the Dungeness River. So there's a lot of ties between here. I go back quite a ways. I was on the advisory committee to PSAM, I think around 2010, 2011, as the representative from the local integrating organizations. And I dropped off that committee because I started working as a backup and standby veterinarian for the National Marine Mammal, U.S. Navy Marine Mammal Program down in Bangor. And I just didn't have time to do both, which brings me up to about 2017 when we had a meeting over in Seattle sponsored by the by NOAA, the National Marine Mammal Foundation, and one other organization which may pop in mind soon. But Ken was there, and I don't know that Steve was there, but John Ford was there, Lance Barrett Leonard was there, and Steve Rafferty was there. A total of 28 people there, including 13 veterinarians. I would posit that that was the expert panel on orcas. I don't, and since Ken was there, he probably would agree with me. So there's a couple of things I want to emphasize, and that anthropogenic and anthropomorphic. I think Lance and Barrett and Leonard and Joe Gatos are the two smartest guys I know. One of them only a veterinarian, but they really have both introduced and used anthropomorphism when it came to the southern resident killer whale population, and they think it's okay in that. And there's been sort of a pattern. If you want to buy into that, into the anthropomorphic, there's been a pattern starting with the carrying around by an orca or calf for 17 days this last summer. That was pretty sad, and if you want to get anthropomorphic, maybe she was just saying, look, guys, here's what you've done to the population, and it's gone. Just go ahead and kiss them goodbye. Now we are a little ways down the line, a couple of months, we see a new baby, and maybe that presents new hope. And today on one of the informational websites, you can see a picture of this this new calf along with a 90-year-old female. And that also presents hope. But there's going to have to be a lot of work for that population, the southern resident population, to be to stop the actually going over the edge extinction. I've been working with orcas since 1966, and I've seen other marine mammals going extinct, and the signs are there, and they're in the literature, and we need to be looking at that literature. And Steve just gave me something that I've been wondering about for the last couple years, and that is, what are the seals and sea lions doing? I refer to pinnipeds, and it's interesting to hear that the harbor seal numbers are trending down. That marine mammal section up in BC that was mentioned earlier on, Lance introduced, maybe didn't introduce, but at least he did to a pretty big audience, if there's a couple thousand, so I will leave the word introduced in there. But Lance mentioned that there needs to be a decrease in pinniped population. And he, with great nerve, alluded to the rehabilitation efforts. Let me go way back to the Marine Mammal Protection Act, 1972. That act was never intended to be a preservation act. That was a management act. Instead, it's acted as a preservation act, and you see what's happened. Maybe the blame is going to pinnipeds fairly, maybe not. But rather than go out and kill some more things, maybe if we just decrease the number of pinnipeds that were saved through rehabilitation efforts and just let nature take its normal attrition course, that has worked up on the islands, San Juan's, and they don't treat animals up there. They pretty much do the necropsies. So there's that to think about. There's more than one way to skin a cat. I'm a clinical veterinarian, and so I think there's more than one way to save an endangered species. But one of the main ways is to try to get back, if you're going to deal with an endangered species as a case, you need first to diagnose what that case is and go through the subjective and objective and differential diagnoses and then come up with a plan. And I don't know, I don't see a plan coming out of the task force. There's a great necessity to integrate data, but also pragmatic management techniques. And that might be something the PSAMP can do. I was on the original PSAMP advisory committee, as I said. I'm now on the Clallam Marine Resources Committee, and we're making a big effort towards the southern residents. What we have found out in the last year is that there's pretty good recovery going on in the northern residents. There's about 250 of those, about 250 transients, but we all know what's happening to the southern residents. The salmon recovery effort started in this state putting the money into it. Steve, maybe you were even there in 1991 when they started the salmon recovery groups, the 14 of those separate groups that have and we're still worried about the decline of salmon, and not only the decline but the actual shortage, which is directly impacting the orca, the southern resident orcas. I'm over 5 minutes.
Can I stop you there? And I think we'll have some more chances to dig deeper into some of these issues a little bit later.
Okay. Well, I just want to get across that there's a lot of thought that needs these efforts. Thank you for your listening.
You bet. How about John Kalimbikidis? You still on?
Yep, I'm still here. I'm with Cascadia Research, based in Olympia, Washington. And we do a lot of our research up and down the West Coast, but being based here on the Salish Sea has, of course, a central interest. A lot of our work is done in collaboration with both WDFW and Steve's research group there, and that includes a couple, both one Section 6 NOAA grant that's ending in the next 6 months, and another one that's starting now that has helped support some of the activities related to some of the large whale populations, especially humpback whales, that we've been doing. We also work pretty closely with NOAA on a couple of different fronts. I think the main new kind of highlights or developments, 2018 saw a major project we did along the West Coast that included Washington assessing humpback whales. It was both part of one of the grants we do through WDFW, but also done coincident with NOAA's West Coast-wide systematic ship line transect survey, and we added a small boat component working with them along the entire West Coast, getting photo ID and samples at a level that has not been achieved in any previous year, and it'll give us one of the best pictures of especially humpback whale distribution, movement, abundance, and especially their stock structure and what areas they migrate to. Humpback whales have been a major long-term focus of our research. It was initially focused off the Washington coast, but increasingly with the expansion of humpback whales into the Salish Sea, we've been doing more work inside the Salish Sea. In 2018, it not only included doing some dedicated surveys there, but also doing some of the initial tag deployments. We deployed some suction cup attached video tags that gave us feeding data to look at prey type of humpback whales in the Salish Sea. We're trying to do more with humpback whales, and especially with their expansion into the Salish Sea, looking more at some of the increased threats they're facing from ship noise, ship strikes, and then a growing issue along the entire west coast of entanglements. Starting in about 2015 along the U.S. west coast has seen a dramatic increase in whale entanglements, especially humpback whales, and many of them involving the Dungeness crab fishery. So that's been a subject of both research and a number of different managements and working groups on that issue that we participate in. Maybe the other thing I'll quickly mention is gray whales. We continue to do long-term research on both the Pacific Coast feeding group of gray whales that feeds in the Pacific Northwest from spring through fall, and then also this small group of whales returns annually to northern Puget Sound to feed, and we do have an expanded effort planned this spring. We haven't gotten funding for it yet, but we'll involve some work with John Durbin and Holly Fernbaugh and trying to do some health assessment of the gray whales, the same individuals that return annually to northern Puget Sound to feed on ghost shrimp. We've deployed tags to look at their feeding behavior. We know how often they feed and what they feed on, and try to get a better assessment of the nutritional gain they get from that area. We are active in strandings, and I think the only other point I'll make, harbor porpoise are a major interest of ours, as well as they are a number of people on this call. We work with harbor porpoise, especially as they relate to strandings, and the only other concern I bring up there is that with the increased number of harbor porpoise in the Salish Sea and Puget Sound in particular, there are a number of issues like entanglement in gillnet gear that, you know, are important areas that we're monitoring. So maybe I'll just hold it there. I'll just say our focus is primarily cetaceans, primarily other than killer whales, since so many groups are active in that, and that's getting a lot of attention. But those are some of the things we have going on.
Let's see. That's a good segue to more harbor porpoise, maybe from Aileen. If you're not unmuted, you should unmute if you're still there. Still not hearing Aileen.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, thank you.
Good. Thank you for allowing me to talk about the harbor porpoise. I'm pleased to be working with Dr. Anna Hall, who's a Canadian research scientist. We want to develop a consistent proposal for protective measures for harbor porpoise for Canada and the U.S., and I'm hoping that by working together, we can get more awareness than we would otherwise. I'm hoping by formalizing some guidelines, we can enlist the Whale Watch and the agencies to make special note of the needs of the harbor porpoise. It's been the forgotten cetacean, and if we can raise awareness, then of course we can protect it better. People are hardly aware that the porpoise form large aggregates several times a year with more than 50 members in these groups. I've been recording this since 2007, and Anna has found a relationship to foraging, mating, and paturation in these aggregates. If we have guidelines, we obviously want to deter boats from moving into the aggregate. At the present time, people are hardly aware of this, and and they would be excited to see that many, and it would be natural for people to move into the group. So, and then there are a number of other things that we want to develop guidelines for, such as protection for the nearshore habitat, protection from ship strike, from underwater noise, a whole number of things like that. And these are detailed in a document that I sent around to everyone. So we'll be developing the guidelines and discussing the options with resource managers and whale watch groups. Thank you.
Thank you, Aileen. How about John Scordino? Are you still on?
Yeah, I'm still on. This is Jonathan Scordino. I'm the marine mammal biologist for the Macaw tribe. I hope you guys can all hear me. I'm not hearing anybody else speak up, so I assume
yep.
I can be heard.
I hear you.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. So the Macaw tribe has a treaty right to the harvest of marine mammals, and because of that, they started their own research program back in 2004, and I'm now the person that runs that program, and I have since 2007. Our primary research efforts are on gray whales, and then while we're doing those surveys, we also survey pinniped haulouts and do incidental recordings of any other marine mammals that we observe. And we've been doing a little bit more on humpback whales, especially as they are coming more into the Strait of Juan de Fuca. So I guess I'll just end that there.
Okay, thank you, John. How about, I guess I wanted to interject that I invited some of our NOAA colleagues, but we know they're furloughed, but Brad and Lynn and Chris Harvey all send their regrets via autoresponder. how about Susan and then Cindy? Make sure you unmute yourself.
I assume you mean Cindy Hansen.
Yes.
Cindy.
Yes. Sorry. Go ahead, Cindy Hansen. Or Susan, whoever wants to go first.
Not anymore. Not me either.
Actually, is there another Cindy on the call?
Yeah, Cindy Ellis, sir.
Cindy Ellis.
All right. Well, actually, Cindy Ellis, you should go next, since we're in your realm.
Okay. I'll stick with the smaller guys besides the orcas, right?
Sure.
I'm with Pacific Mammal Research, a nonprofit I started in 2014 in Anacortes, Washington. And our main thing, we work with harbor porpoises and harbor seals. And our main thing is the photo ID and long-term monitoring of the two species. So we're a small group up here, but we have collaborations throughout the Salish Sea, and we work up with Anna Hall and the Porpoise Conservation Society in Canada, and the Whale Museum, and then and obviously in Washington here, and down in Puget Sound with the Eco Marine Institute, and SR3, and amongst other ones that we're trying to get a larger look as to where these animals go, so we can get some pictures from various places. And I know people laugh when you say take pictures of harbor porpoises and get IDs, but you can do it. So we also do harbor seals, trying to look at more fine scale population of both animals. We're trying to kind of be a regional database for both species, people being able to send in photos and be able to really kind of track where they all go. Just a little bit about what we found so far. We have over 70 individuals that we've identified, with about 35% resided in our study area. And we do see seasonal differences in when they're there, and differences in when we see calves, and group size slightly different when they're feeding, when they're not. We're mainly land-based, but now we have a small boat that got donated to us this year, so we're going to start hopefully being able to get out soon. Not all the way to the Salish Sea, because it's only a small 13-foot boat, but around some of the lower islands, close to Fidalgo Island, where we are. So we are just looking to learn more about these guys. As Aileen mentioned, harbor porpoises are often overlooked, and they are really important And so we want to learn as much as we can about them and work with everybody around the... sorry if you can hear the dog barking. Those are my dogs.
Terrestrial.
We can learn as much as we can by collaborating with everybody around the Salish Sea and see what we can figure out about these animals. So I think that's roughly... we do a lot of education as well throughout the area of marine mammals. So that...
All right. Thank you, Cindy. Let's see. How about Susan Berta and then Cindy Hansen?
Is our microphone working?
Yes, I hear you, Susan.
Are we on?
How are you going to Susan Berta with Working Network. So we've been doing our sighting network in some form for about 20 years. I have to say my highlight this year was watching Beachfly and listening to them on the new First Point hydrophone. Thanks for working with that.
Hey, Susan.
It's really cool. Yeah.
We are mostly coming through, but I think if you could get closer to the speaker, it might be a little less garbled.
Okay. Is that any better?
Yes.
Okay. Otherwise, I'm calling on my phone. Okay, so we've been on a sighting network for about 20 years. Have seen a lot of changes. Did not used to see humpbacks at all. We now see them, it's a regular sighting. We moved the switch to see more champions, less residents, of course. Weird things going on with the last year. Three new ones who have stayed all winter long. My highlight was being able to listen to J5 when they went by Fort Point while we were watching them. And that's been a long time dream of ours. They often tend to go by at night, so we can't see them, so we at least can listen to them now. I'm glad to be a part of this group. I have to say that since the early 90s, when I worked for the Beach Watchers program and the Salmon Recovery Board was starting, the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority had just started. We're trying to see that before coming to the watershed. And I think task forces come and go. So it's hard to not feel a little discouraged that we meet and talk a lot. And so it's good to try to find some good things that have happened. And I've seen a lot of changes in public opinion and a lot of inspiration done. I think we're headed in the right direction.
Hey, Susan, we're starting to lose your voice again. It was pretty clear for a bit.
Okay. Well, I'll let Hal go.
Can we hear this okay, Scott?
Yes, I think as long as you're nice and loud, it's not too garbled.
Okay. We've, as Susan said, been conducting the sighting network for over 20 years. And in 2018, we just got our summaries, and we had 3,200 individual reports of orcas in particular by 1,150 different individuals, which was about the same as 2017. And the bigs, transients, dominated for most of the year, except for November and December, when southern residents came into Puget Sound foraging for chum. We send out these reports to about 15,000 people on our email list on a roughly weekly basis. So that's a lot of people that are involved. So what we do is sort of gross tracking of the whales through all of this just citizen sighting involvement in them. But of course, we draw from everybody's research. Of course, the Center for Whale Research, but also Brad Hansen, Sam Wasserner, Lance Barrett-Leonard, John Durbin, everybody else's work to sort of inform us so that we can turn around and inform all of those people. So we're sort of a conduit for all that information both ways, from the people and from the research community. And of course, what we're facing now is a kind of a code red situation of the imminent extinction of the southern residents, which is exciting a whole lot of emotions and issues with a whole lot of people to try to get something done. And from all of the research that we've been able to glean, the consensus is that it's a prey-limited population that is not viable because of the decrease in that prey base. And the solutions that appear would be the restoration of the spawning habitat, the primary spawning habitat of the Chinook salmon, their primary prey, or a significant decrease in the harvest of them. And both of those solutions face formidable, probably insurmountable political objections, so it doesn't seem that there is any likely path to actually significantly increase their prey base. So there's just a whole lot of concern about that. And so that is what we're sort of, you know, primarily focused on, is trying to solve that problem. We advocate for the whales. We also educate using all of this information that we can. And our preference would be just to offer good natural history and current events education. And we still do that, of course. But we are, and I think our member base or subscriber base is very much concerned with how going to help these whales. So that's a big part of our focus. So thank you for the chance to talk.
Thank you, Howie. Cindy Hansen, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm the education and events coordinator for Orca Network. So basically what Susan and Howie just said, but I can just add that I and mostly involved with our public education efforts, like Howie was saying, so we do presentations, workshops, events, et cetera. And then I've also been involved in advocacy efforts as a steering committee member of the Orca Salmon Alliance, which has 17 member groups. I also attended all the task force meetings on behalf of Orca Network and helped with public engagement on commenting on the task force recommendations. So just really trying to get the word out there to the public and get them engaged and involved.
You have a marine mammal highlight from 2018?
I do. I think my highlight was probably when almost a full super pod came down San Juan Channel, which is the route they normally don't take, and they came right past the neighborhood where I live. So I ran down the hill to see them. So in the middle of all this sadness we faced here with the whales, it was just a nice reminder of why we're doing what we do.
All right, let's see. I think last on the list is Val Veers and then myself.
Well, I could say that I've been working with Scott. I'm actually working for Scott for the last 20 years. And what we've been working is trying to keep a bunch of hydrophones streaming to the internet. That's been the most continuous thing we've tried to do. Hydrophones at our home here just north of the Center for Whale Research, at Limekiln, and at various times, Port Townsend, downtown Seattle, Nia Bay, and now most recently Bush Point, and more possibilities coming. So So much of my activity has been just trying to keep all these things running, keep the streaming, fixing things. And what Scott and I have learned over the years is that we're measuring the sounds right in the foraging hot spots of the killer whales. And by that I mean not just the Salish Sea, but I mean up against the rocks where the animals often forage looking for salmon that are tucked away in the rocks that sometimes we see pictures of in wonderful underwater videos that Florian Ringer or others make. And so we believe that the noises, the sounds we're recording are pretty representative of the sound environment the whales are in when they're trying to forage. And given that the prey are hard to find because there are too few of them, and given that it takes a long time, if ever, as Howie just pointed out, to fix the source of new fish or to fight with the fishers about the harvest, the part that we pay attention to is how effective the echolocation and communication calls can be in communicating foraging, and how difficult that may be within the soundscape that we record all the time. The Canadians have taken this much, much more seriously than people in the United States have. And Scott and I have been to many meetings in Canada where people are talking seriously about what can they do to reduce noise in the critical habitat of the whales. And as you know, the ECHO program's been an experiment that the Port of Vancouver has been carrying out. The Port of Seattle just sits there silent as a clam without participating in these questions. And we believe and have published in the peer-reviewed literature that big ships are the dominant noise source and have plenty of energy in the frequency range of the whales to make it more difficult for them to work. And that my feeling for this group is that they need to help the state of Washington bring commercial shipping into the conversation so we don't just talk about, you know, prey and pollution, which are important. We don't just talk about whale watch boats, which we feel are not very important if they are moving slowly 200 meters away or more from the whales. So underwater noise is our thing, and trying to bring more awareness to people is our main product and the thing that we feel we've learned and other people haven't learned enough is that big ships are an important part of this and need to be brought into the conversation. Thanks much.
All right, we're pretty much on time in terms of where I wanted to be, but I'm Scott Veers. I run BeamReach, which is a social purpose corporation based in Seattle, and I help coordinate the Orca Sound Hydrophone Network, which is my highlight from 2018. Is something you can listen to on our website. Down at the very bottom is a little play button. And last February, I was just listening to the hydrophone in Val's backyard, which is the west side of San Juan Island, and I heard something I'd never heard after 10 years of listening, which, if you listen to it with headphones on, is quite the sonic experience. But the first time since, say, 1986, a sperm whale came through the Salish Sea from the north end of Vancouver Island and then out through the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And so for me, that was both inspirational, amazing acoustic experience, but also a reminder that the ecosystem is changing, and if we monitor it, we sometimes get very interesting observations of marine mammals that are not the resident normal ones that we often have the chance to study. So that's part of what's been motivating me is that sperm whale, which was dubbed Yukasam by the folks up in Canada, taught me a lot about killer whale biology, just in terms of thinking more broadly about echolocation, and made me realize that the hydrophones, which picked up that young male sperm whale, both in Canada and then the DFO hydrophones in the Strait of Georgia, and then our hydrophones, and the Whale Museum's hydrophones in Harrow Strait, and then again DFO and ONC hydrophones in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, really mapped out the movement of a marine mammal we'd never paid attention to. So I think the stage is set for acoustic monitoring to really help us inform those species that either aren't on the surface very often for visual surveys, but still make acoustic sounds, or that we just haven't paid attention to before, or even heard. So let me get you back to the... was there anybody else who joined or wanted to add anything? Because we, I think we've made it through this section of introductions. It's a little bit past 1:30. I think we're at 1:40.
Hello. Can people hear me? Hello.
Yes.
Hi, this is Frances Robertson. I'm also on the call. I think there are a fair few number of other people on the call that haven't introduce themselves, maybe.
Great.
But I'll go ahead and introduce myself. I'm Dr. Frances Robertson. I'm the Marine Program Coordinator for San Juan County. So we are leading the county's southern resident killer whale recovery effort here, combining studies with outreach and education, as well as support for our county representatives on the task force. I will make one plug here. We will be at the Seattle Boat Show for Be Whale Wives in 2 weeks, which was a connection we made at the task force with the head of the Northwest Marine Trade Association. So Be Whale Wives will have a prominent booth there with the opportunity to educate around 14,000 recreational boaters with the added bonus that if people want to enter to win the Seattle Seahawks season tickets, which here in Washington State is a pretty big deal, you have to come to the Be Whale Wives booth and pledge to Be Whale Wives. I've also studied minke whales here in the Salish Sea with the late Dr. Jonathan Stern, and I would maybe add there that they are perhaps the forgotten whale of the Salish Sea. But so that's a bit of my background, and I'll pass it on to anyone else who is on the call also. Thank you.
And thank you. Anybody else on the call that I haven't heard yet? Okay. Great. Thank you. Sorry, Frankie, that I missed you there. If anybody else is on, wants to jump in, don't hesitate. But I'm going to go back to the agenda. The first order of formal business is just to, we were asked by the steering committee to formalize the process by which we choose our leadership. So just want to spend a few moments making sure that both Jerry and I have made the overture and the offer for anybody who would like to help lead this group is welcome to. I am still willing to do that, but I'm also very willing to have a co-chair or an assistant chair. So is anyone on the line interested in nominating themselves or nominating someone else in the community for a leadership role? I asked the same thing on the Google forum, and I was nominated a couple of times, so I'll forego any sort of statement. And let's just have a quick vote. Jerry, would you like to take the role?
Let me take this. So I spent 3 years looking for a chair and function after being a chair for a while, and we created ourselves again. I was temporary acting chair, spent quite a while looking for it. Scott was very kind to step forward for this position, but in discussions with others, we felt that it would be unfair to arbitrarily appoint Scott as the chair. So we appointed him as acting chair, pending a ratification by the work group. So unless there are others that step forward, and I note that many other work groups have either co-chair or vice chair or co-vice chairs and some other structure to give the chair a hand. So people may think about that down the road anyhow. But unless there's a any other person that wants to step forward now, and I'll give everybody a minute or a few seconds. Okay, hearing none, what I would suggest is a that we, the group, decides that or agrees that Scott will be the chair, no longer acting chair, but real chair, and so I call the question on that. Are there, without hearing from everyone, are there any objections? Hearing none, but I think by acclamation, we have now elected Scott to be the chair and no longer acting chair. Congratulations and my sympathies.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Jerry. Let's see, I guess I wanted to make sure that everyone was welcomed as new members. There, as far as I can tell, there is no formal process for just becoming a member, so continue to spread the word. If you know of colleagues who would like to participate, you're gonna, everyone's always welcome to either come to the meetings or listen in on them and vote and engage as a member if you see fit. There were, in the Google form, the RSVPs, there were a few suggestions of agenda items. We could discuss these in the process, and we may revisit them when we talk about the work plan shortly, but I guess I would like to open it up to anybody who might have submitted these to lead a discussion. If we haven't already talked enough about any of these, let's take them one at a time. One suggestion was to discuss harbor seal trend counts as an indicator of Puget Sound health. Anyone want to own that and or talk about it?
This is Steve Jeffries. I didn't suggest it, but as far as trend counts, the biggest impediment to doing trend counts for harbor seals is conducting the surveys and having funding to do the survey. So and we usually, because it's there are stocks and that you know us tasked with documenting stocks, we've kind of deferred to NOAA to fund work. And the last time they funded the study was 2014. So if we want to do trends, we need to do counts. So that's, you know, can't do trends without counts. So, and I said this earlier, I think there needs to be a link with the BC Washington counting.
Steve, I've been trying to get information about what's included in the governor's budget from other agencies related to monitoring, and I got some spreadsheets from WDFW, mm-hmm. and it looked like there was something related to pinnipeds, but it wasn't clear to me what it was. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, in the budget proposals, I mean, there is money in there for, under recommendation 12 and 13, there is money identified to do a number of studies, and they're going through the amount of, we're in the process of seeing how much everything will cost, and we're going to end up with things costing more than there is enough money to do. So, but long story short, there is a proposal to and a funding proposal to do surveys, but it's not clear.
And that's what wasn't clear to me, was whether that was for surveys or whether it was some other thing. Maybe it was policy related. It wasn't clear in the very brief line in there. So just the additional context was helpful.
Yeah, I mean, it's back to another one of those questions about culling. You know, if the seal populations or harbor seal populations are actually decreasing because of transient predation, and we're using the data that we're using is from 1999. I mean, we've been asking NOAA to do its new stock assessment report for Washington and Oregon, actually Washington and Oregon harvest field stocks, and they have the data that they're using in their stock assessments are outdated. They can't even use the data, they're so old. So that's in the works. Again, it's, and I'm not sure whether it's a one-time survey. Ideally, the Canadians, DFO, they're going to do a Strait of Georgia survey this year, 2019. The money that's being talked about in the governor's budget and the legislative budget won't even become available to July 1st. So there's not even any money. So for us, the time crunch is going to be, if there's money identified to do these surveys, that it becomes available in 2019 as soon as possible. Because otherwise, if we do surveys in conjunction with the Canadians, we'll have the whole Salish Sea. We will have, anyway.
When's the ideal time to conduct the survey?
Well, the surveys in the San Juan, they're linked with pupping season and molt. So typically those surveys are going to be mid-July to late August and low tide cycles. That's the window. And what we would want to do is coordinate the same survey window with basically the same window that DFO was flying. So, but it's going to be right after July 1st. Yeah, we need to be ready to go. Until the legislature comes up with the final budget, or we have a final budget, we won't know. If we know that that funding's in there, then we can plan. It's going to be difficult for me to do the survey. I've done the assessment surveys that's shown on the screen there. I've done surveys the last 40 years, so the data set is kind of my data set. But I'm going to have to be ready to go on July 1st. I'm going to have to schedule planes because I need to do it in advance, because if I don't, the planes aren't going to be available. So I guess long story short,
all of us in state agencies are in the same boat, planning the best we can to use the money we might get.
Yeah.
But we're doing the same thing with the PSEM funding too.
Well, and again, I think this is kind of getting into the weeds a little bit, but we need to work with NOAA to have them come up with funding. The last surveys that we did in 14 were funded by NOAA and the U.S. Navy. So, I think the Navy probably, we haven't approached the Navy, but maybe in the short term we could maybe get Navy funding to be committed. But, it'd be nice to this transboundary thing, coordinating surveys, right? Because we're, I'm assuming transients are eating Canadian seals as well as U.S. seals. So, if you look at the Gulf Islands, there's probably as many. The highest densities of harvest seals are in the San Juan Islands. They're the greatest abundance in the San Juans, and there's a like number of animals in the Gulf Islands just across the border. So they all play into the modeling of predation by pinnipeds relative to salmon consumption. So anyway,
one question I had, Steve, is, I was looking around for where the public might learn about seal trends, partially related to the culling questions that were coming out of some of the recommendations. And this is one thing I found on the Encyclopedia of Puget Sound. And we have now an invitation from both Jeff Rice and Joe Gatos to update these as an activity of the work group, if we so choose. I'm just wondering, for this trend, these count data, it looks like it ends in the late 90s, are there more published data that could be presented to the public at this point, or not?
Probably not. Well, I mean, there's bits and pieces. I think we presented some stuff to the task force on, and the predation workshop. What's complicating the issue is we survey in the summertime, and there's a lot more disturbance that's going on, and there's the counts fluctuate a lot more. Mm-hmm. You know, so the trend data that we have from the latest data points that we have, latest survey, the 2014 surveys that we did.
Yeah.
You know, the data is confusing because the trends aren't really clear, and these decreases may, for example, it looks like the Hood Canal seal population has decreased substantially, but all those counts come from five main haul-out sites, and all those five sites are heavily disturbed in the summertime. So are the low numbers an artifact of disturbance? I don't think we're ready to have that data circulated too much because we're kind of scratching our heads because we don't know really what it means. San Juan Island is the same. The data that's in that trend paper that's in the encyclopedia. When that data was collected in the San Juans, there's a lot more kayak companies around, and they all seek reefs and protect them. You know, they. I don't want to disparage the kayak watching community because I think it's a good activity. But when I'm flying an airplane, I've got five kayakers paddling towards Clements Reef where there's 300 harbor seals that are about to be spooked into the water. It's a race. So there's a lot more disturbance going on that we. So the correcting for the counts is probably needs to be addressed. You know. How much, it's a bigger effort than just counting them. We can count them, but we have to interpret what that means.
Okay.
Again, I
had a quick question. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
We're land-based, so we do, but we have, we're working this year on the last 4 years of data we have on the harbor seals coming into our study area. And then, as we said, we're getting a small boat, so we would be able to start doing some smaller surveys, you know, not in a large area, but a smaller area in the lower San Juans, you know, by Fidalgo Island, Guemes, and Lopez, and things like that. Is that, like, how does that stack up with, I know doing the trends is you want to have, like, you know, the whole Salish Sea, but where could our stuff fit into helping with that? Like, would our smaller survey from the boat be useful in a larger... context, or our stuff from our one study area where we see these animals come back, or identifying them over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is you need to establish a long-term monitoring program, and it has to go on. It's like killer whales. You know, we've been monitoring for them forever. So,
right.
I think the data that you get from your land-based site is going to be valuable over time. It's in the short term, 4 years probably. You know, you need 3 years for a trend, so you can get, you know. But I think that the other data set that we have, and it's actually not my data set, it's a data set that Scott Pearson has, and it's kind of like the one that Jan Newton has, where she's got density, we've got density estimates from these seabird surveys, and the trend data that I think was in the recent transient paper that mentions a decline in harbor seal densities was data that Scott's collected from seabird surveys, surveying a big area, and basically the trend in harbor seal densities has. I mean, some people have seen his data, but the harbor seal sightings on their surveys is down, and he actually has data on harbor porpoise, and he sees a big density increase in harbor porpoise. So, in water surveys, will give you that trend data over time, and then, and you know so, but it we need it over a bigger geographic area, that where the count data, the aerial surveys that we do is actually gives us the total count that feeds into the stock assessment documents that NOAA produces.
And that Pearson work, that's all winter survey, right?
No, Scott's doing year-round surveys, mm-hmm. But he's doing those surveys primarily for the Navy. You know, the Navy's got a whole bunch of a lot of interest in what's going on in Puget Sound because of their assets and their facilities. So, but his surveys are ongoing, like I said, and you know. In the short term, we can get a data point to plug in. We've got, you go back to that that map. So we've actually got bits and pieces. We did some work in the San Juan Islands where we've got counts in Area 4 from this map, but we don't have counts in different years in 2014. So we've got bits and pieces from those. Seven areas, but we don't have 2014 is the last year that we've got surveys from all those areas in the same year. So we can do trends, like I say, in those sub areas. I think if you look at area 3, 4, 5, the trend looks like it's, if you go back to that trend line, if you look at the data's that we have after 2000, if you get rid of the first from 1975 to 1995 and look at the last 20 years or 20 years of data, it's actually probably flat or declining. I don't think there's any area that there's an indication that there's any increase. The population probably stabilized in the early 2000s and maybe overshot. You may be overshot whatever K was, and now there's been a decline. And, you know, transient killer whales really, the first big influx of transients was in 2003 and 2005 in the Hood Canal. That was sort of the start of the floodgate of transients. So if they've been hammering the population since 2005, in the last almost 15 years, it could actually be reduced.
This is Jerry. To put this in a little bit of context, I know you'd like to have a survey done this year, but in a longer context, as far as what's going on here with partnership and the priorities, so besides the issue of the resident killer whale and the idea of culling, et cetera, there are two other mandates where this type of thing would fit in. One is that there's going to be a reevaluation of the vital signs, a scientific reevaluation of the vital signs. So there will be sort of discussions on more sensitive vital signs to indicate trends and health. And the second one is this requirement to provide data for adaptive management. And I can't think of anything more if you're talking in terms of southern resident killer whale management or whatever and things like that, to have data on your pinnipeds would be really important. So even if this doesn't come through this budget cycle, there are these upcoming things, items, priorities that could be very important in this discussion could continue and look at the possible funding. I would find it extremely surprising if there's any move for pinniped management in the U.S. portion of the Salish Sea without having a recent assessment and looking at the adaptive management aspects of it. I know that you guys have a lot better data for the Columbia, and there's more discussion of active management there. So those are just a couple points to think of down the road and putting this in perspective, particularly like in a work plan and how this will apply over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I would just add the other thing that we've been working on, and when we started when we were when harbor seals were an indicator species early on, and we were getting money to do surveys and do contaminants, that when that funding went away, we've still done surveys as we can, and we've still been working with Peter Ross, and he's actually at the Vancouver Aquarium now, on doing still contaminant monitoring. So we're still, we've got the big long trend on harbor seal contaminants, and I do think that, that we actually collected samples this year for Southern Puget Sound to compare with Canadian samples. And Peter's been pretty active in looking at new things that are in the environment. You know, he's in the microplastics right now, but anyway, we do have additional data on contaminants that we will have from our work with DF, or actually with what are they not the Vancouver Aquarium, what are they now? Centers, yeah, whatever their new name is, whatever the name is.
Yes.
Oceans Alliance or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, some all-encompassing name. But anyway.
One thing I'm struck by is that compared to harbor porpoises, these surveys look pretty tractable, and they're all relatively near shore, which makes me think citizen science monitoring might be a possibility. I don't know if a drone-based protocol might work, but
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you know the question about the surveys around Lummi Island, that area. I mean, there's some haul-out sites that are just, you know, really small, and there's some really big ones that really, you know, like Smith Minor and Protection mm-hmm. Island and Dundee. You really some sites that are really big, and some that are small and probably call them insignificant, but they all add up. But again, it's, you're not going to probably see a trend in a site that can, like some of those rocks on the south, Colville Island, and some of those reefs on the south side of Lummi, there's only space for like 50 animals, so you're not going to really see, they're probably full, and the trend is probably, you're not going to see it. You might see seasonal use patterns. You know, again, it's, I think collecting data and individual sites and using citizen science and drones may be an option. We've got a group right now we're working with in the Columbia River doing sea lion counts, citizen science, sea lion counts, shore-based sea lion counts in the Columbia River, and they've been doing it for 4 years. And they're actually seeing some trends in what their data, but they're wondering if their data is, should we keep counting? And I'm saying, well, you can't see anything if you stop. Mm-hmm. So I just encourage people to, you know, figure out if it's, find some sites and concentrate on those sites. And I can help you find sites around the area that you, if you want to do, you probably want to do shore-based stuff. Anyway.
John Scordino, do you think there's an overlap with the California Sea Lion brand photos in that effort?
With the California Sea Lion what photos?
Oh, I remember sending you some branded California Sea Lions.
Yeah, the branded California and Stellar Sea Lions.
Yep.
So we do monitoring at sites out here where we have a lot of harbor seal haul-outs that we monitor. As well as the Stellar and California Sea Lion sites. So we have trends in that. And, you know, I think it might have been me that emailed in saying that harbor seals should be considered as a species for a priority for an indicator, primarily because of Steve's paper finding that they were at carrying capacity back in early 2000s. So once the population's at carrying capacity, it will be most sensitive to changes in that environment. So if there's a decline in productivity and food and stuff, you should see a change in the population. And I don't think that's the case for harbor porpoise and for and then I think like for southern resident killer whales, we have many other factors going on So it seems like if you want to get a good idea of health to Puget Sound, having a species that stays local and doesn't use areas outside of Puget Sound, and a species that was at carrying capacity would be, you know, our best indicator. I think it's encouraging that some people are doing some individual site research, like we're hearing around Lummi Island, and I have some here on the western side of the strait. And maybe through citizen science we can get more sites, you know, that representative through Hood Canal and, you know, maybe San Juan's that could complement all the different study sites that are going on and complement
up here in Fidalgo Island.
Okay, but yeah, complement the areas where there's not research going on, or complement the aerial surveys and fill in the data gaps between aerial surveys. But yeah, the main thing is the population being at carrying capacity in 2000 is why I would think it would be a really good indicator for what's the health of Puget Sound.
Any more thoughts on that?
No. I'm all done, Scott.
All right. Let's see. Does anybody own this comment that's online? Or do we want to talk about this more now, or call it an emerging event that we should talk about at our next meeting?
Tell us what it is, Scott.
Oh, sorry. For those of you who can't see my screen, this was a suggestion that we have some type of discussion or response to the pinniped calling issue, as it seems timely.
I'll just add some comments. Like I said earlier, that we gave a presentation to the commission, our Fish and Wildlife Commission, in early December, and if people can find it online and look at it. And I think there were a number of people that had public testimony. Deborah Giles was one of them. Casey McLean. So there were like six or seven people that actually testified, I think, and basically said, you know, it's way more complicated than just removing seals from the equation. So I think the commission basically heard that, you know, culling is probably not, you know, the immediate immediate management solution to the problem. So if people heard Andrew, apparently there's a group in Canada that's proposing to kill half the harvest seal populations in the Strait of Georgia. So I always tell people that we're governed by what we can do under the MMPA, and culling the whole population is not going to be allowed under the MMPA. So the safeguard for everybody is going to be, you know, the PBR levels that are allowable under the MMPA, which requires some surveys to figure out how many there are, but it's not, you know, the PBR for Southern Puget Sound that we've calculated right now, which is the allowable removal from all human caused sources, is about 40 seals. So, I mean, what can you do with, anyway, I just think that the whole discussion is kind of, it's not going anywhere at the moment, although there's still people with guns and bullets proposing the solution to the problem is, you know, removing seals and sea lions from the equation. And I do think that one of the things that happened is we've got people that are calling for a pinniped call for the reason that they interfere with their fisheries, and they're not that it's going to recover Chinook to benefit killer whales. So there, it's more of a, if we got rid of all the seals, I wouldn't be losing fish that I get when I catch them off of, you know, Cattle Point or whatever. So there's a, you know, if you invest in, there's a lot of people that are, have other interests that aren't necessarily, you know, recovering Chinook salmon to, you know, help southern resident killer whales. So anyway, but we're in the middle of that political arena because all those constituents have the ear of our director and the governor and other people. So the issue's not going to go away because, you know, and the tribes would, you know.
So just to maybe direct that a little bit, I think it's obviously like a huge issue. So I guess wonder, do you see a role for this group or for the role of how we communicate science to offer something to that conversation or to help bring more understanding to, and maybe we can start thinking about, like, is there really an opportunity and is there a need? And maybe it's leave it alone, let's not spend our energy there. But I guess just when these things come up, that's just trying to remember what is the niche of this group and how we want to drive the energy and this all the people who have come to the call to collaborate and share.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that you know, the Marine Waters Report, and all the other, you know, the venues that I work in, like the South Sound Science Symposium, and all the work that's being done with the through this process, the partnership needs to be more vocal about how killing seals is short sighted, and the system is way more complicated than that. And so.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what we want to see and distill is like, what is the, and is a role that I think is mostly an untapped role for PSEMP in particular, and we've articulated in the plan, there's been a lot of discussion of like, okay, there's some key messages in understanding of the ecosystem that's being missed. There's been a lack of capacity, I think, on the science side in the partnership, which has been acknowledged, and we want to meet this need that's been unmet. So this is what I'm asking is, if maybe this is a future discussion, but if the group comes up with the core message, and also best messaging consistently about these kinds of things is important for public communication, especially, right? So, like, if it's coming out of PSEMP and it's also being and then amplified through the partnership system, that's something that we want to support.
Yeah, I mean, so. I guess if you go back to the indicator species ring, I think what's difficult.
PSEMP can go beyond vital science, not just vital science.
I'm just saying what the dilemma or the issue for us is that. As an agency or resource manager, we typically have been doing single species management, and we're actually talking about ecosystem management, and it's the transition from, you know, we manage salmon, you know. Anyway, it's the whole integration of these bits and pieces into a more comprehensive, you know, we're talking about an Atlantis model or whatever,
yeah.
some model for long-term management and a long-term commitment to that goal. And then maybe that's how we interact with the bigger group, just saying we need more integration of these models and put all these other
right, and that's something
bits
too,
and pieces.
I think there's a challenge and an opportunity, particularly with, there's already these work groups in PSEMP and sort of revitalizing this one, revitalizing the salmon work group, or revitalizing the modeling work group too, and bringing together conversations there and spatial data and tools. So I think this is where not only getting this group together, but also thinking about, okay, yeah, where do we need to collaborate or share a message or develop a common, you know, yeah, what is the change you want to see, or what's the missing information that's out there? And then that's an opportunity, I think, for PSEMP as a whole, and not just thinking about the Marine Mammals Work Group or this group or that work group, but how do we bring a deeper understanding to the ecosystem and the connections that in a meaningful way? And I think that's a big challenge, but there's we have an opportunity and want to Maybe some more stuff to do.
And my comment about the vital signs rings, the ring, it's basically you've got whatever 12 species or whatever indicators, and it actually simplifies it. If I look at this, I'm in the public, and you're going to need to deal with herring, orcas, chinook, salmon, and birds. You know, it's more complex than that, and that's how you convey that message. I think that's I think this ring simplifies it too much. If you got indicator species, how do you integrate all this stuff?
Those are the conversations that have been happening around the need for the vital signs revision process. Also, you'll notice there's a lot of apples and oranges up here. So some things are sort of like, big scale like orcas, and other things are more about tracking actions like shoreline armoring. So there's also been a discussion about developing, so we're tracking sort of vital signs, and it's a big level, and then we're tracking like near-term action implementation and stuff like that. And so that's at the very close-term level, but we're kind of missing the in-between measurements. So right now the partnership is developing some things called progress measures to sort of fill that gap, and then that's happening, and we'll also public forum and maybe even free up the vital signs in these indicators to clarify what their intention is, what their purpose is, and get a better set that will tell us more. And so probably not touching the human ones, because those were just developed much more recently, and I think had some more current thought put into them. But anyway, there will be more. We'll bring more of that to this group, but just so you know, there's going to be opportunities to improve this system in a way that works for more.
So you're changing there's a proposal to change these vital signs?
Uh-huh.
I mean, if I look at this ring and I look at the herring, orca, chinook, bird thing, and I look at the below it, thriving species and food webs, I would change that. That's actually should be species in trouble, not thriving.
So, and this is where maybe it's also that this hasn't been communicated super well. So the outer ring, and for those who can't see the screen, you can pull up the vital signs wheel, but those are the goals and statutes. And so those are the goals, and then that's not super clear unless you have all the background.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We've simplified it for a reason. Mm-hmm. Because it's complicated, we try to simplify, and maybe we simplified it too much.
Yeah. So there's going to be a process to sort of reevaluate this, and this is what Jerry's been referring to, but it probably merits an actual presentation and conversation. And Ron Baum is the science lead for this project. And we're going to be getting going soon on it and inviting partners in to participate.
And one other point, and Janet brought this up before, was that because we're charged with providing information assessments, or one of our goals, providing information for adaptive management, PSEMP goes well beyond vital signs and goes well beyond. This has actually been some level of conflict for a while until we finally defined that what we need to do is go well. So we're not limited at all by this, because we are involved in the issues of providing the information for adaptive management, which gives us essentially a free rein to do whatever we want. The other thing is that, so PSEMP, even though the abbreviation is the way it is, it's actually a monitoring and assessment program, not just a monitoring program. And the as I mentioned before, science panel is looking more for us to provide the data and assessments so that they can work with the science and policy. So that gives us a lot of power along those lines. It doesn't mean that we cannot,
We'll have our own partnerships to policy and communication too. It's not just constrained by the science panel.
So that just gives an idea that we can do whatever we feel is important that provides us with information of the status or of the ecosystem, what's happening, interactions, whatever. The issue of pinniped populations, I think, is a critical aspect. If there's going to be policy decisions, they don't have the data, up-to-date data. So that would be a critical aspect of the role. We would need to do, foster assessment.
Yeah.
I think we should move on to the work plan. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Steve, do you have any data on the Stranding Network's rehabilitation efforts on pinnipeds since they started, say, for the last 10 years?
I think Kristen Wilkinson Noel probably has that data. We should give him a call.
Okay.
But yeah, I think that, you know, all the data is out there. I don't know that we rehab that many animals. There's not that many facilities, you know. Again, I think harbor seals we probably do a couple dozen a year, which probably is probably insignificant. It's not like
California. It's a question.
Go ahead.
It may be significant, but it may not be.
Can I jump in for a second? This is Cindy with Orca Network. I also personally am on the board for Wolf Hollow Wildlife Rehabilitation Center on San Juan Island. We do maybe 8 to 10 per year, if that. And the only other organization that is licensed to do pinniped at this point that's up and running is Paws in Linwood, and they even do less than we do. So we're talking less than 20 animals a year.
That's good news.
Yeah, I mean, I think the message has always been that, you know, there's a better chance for survival if they're left in the wild, if they're, you know, rather than bringing them in. So it's more as an education thing to some degree.
Yeah, and they're ones that are broken in because of human interference of some sort. And the Stranding Networks make the decisions on whether or not they're going to send them for rehab.
So I'd like to suggest that we move to a couple other agenda items, or at least have touched on them. We've got about 35 minutes left. So let's table, let's continue to discuss this next time, and maybe off in between this and the next meeting. And I think also this issue, before we leave it, I'm curious to know if anyone is on the line that provided it, but I'd like to table a discussion on it. That's near and dear to my heart. I'm sure we'll get back to underwater noise.
And I feel like it is definitely a focus of the partnership, so I don't think that's really an issue. I think there will definitely be those opportunities with Todd, for instance.
Yes. So let's return to that. The main goal today was at least to discuss a work plan for 2019, and I have some discussion questions that we could waltz around and through, but the main point is just to have a discussion about what we think we could accomplish in 2019, what we'd like to aspire to. Ideally, whatever we chose to do as a group would align to some extent with the strategic plan, which, as Jenna reiterated, is trying to ask for more collaboration amongst ourselves or between work groups, and trying to inform adaptive management and the ability to evaluate effectiveness of particular actions based on monitoring data. So work plan elements, also we could highlight places where we'd like to try to make initial linkages with other work groups. We've talked a little bit about vital signs and possibly starting discussions of either modifying what we have for orcas or supplementing it with other vital signs. So that could be part of it. There was a request from PSAMP to try to identify, if we can, capacity or funding needs. And then, you know, I'm particularly interested in talking about data products that might not be as big and complicated as the annual report that Marine Waters generates, but could be incremental steps to informing the public on issues that we're monitoring. So I just wanted to flash up a couple of ideas. Unfortunately, Jane and Monica couldn't join us today, but they said they're interested in collaborating, and I just wanted to show a couple of figures that Ken could show also. Here. So one of the things that I've seen the center present that I find really inspiring is juxtapositions of Southern resident population data or movement data with the information about the main salmon prey populations they're focused on, either with Fraser River with this Albion test fishery or counts from the Bonneville Dam on the Columbia. But this is just an example of, I've really enjoyed as a scientist, this Jane's ability to integrate time series from prey and predator. And I'm wondering if we can do that for, whether we have the data to do that for other species, and particularly whether we can update that more than just annually or quarterly, or even in some cases, if we are thinking about the occupancy rates of transients and or Biggs whales and southern residents in Puget Sound, that's something that Orca Network reports on a weekly basis. So that's just an example of sighting summaries that the center's already generating these annually, but they're not surfacing in any of the sort of Puget Sound specific online resources that I've seen. And Monica's publication, if you haven't seen it, I'm happy to circulate it, but it was a nice look at how the Biggs whales are becoming resident relative to the residents. Mm-hmm. If you could also take a look on the Orca Network site at what they provide to the public on a weekly and monthly basis, which I think we could do perhaps if, for other species, or in a way that magnifies what they do. And the last little thing I thought would be good for just catalyzing a vision for the work group is there are these types of documents that reach the public more than anything we've done in the past. There's a state of the sound that gets generated on both sides of the border. There are those sorts of broad oceanographic integrations of what happened either in Puget Sound or even in the BC Pacific region. There's the Marine Waters Annual Report, which we've talked about. The Encyclopedia of Puget Sound, where we have an invitation to update articles which already exist, but not for all species that inhabit Puget Sound. There's articles on the southern residents, on harbor seals, on seals and sea lions. And there's the state of the ocean that Ocean Networks Canada puts together on the other side. There's probably more on the BC side that I'm not aware of. But all of those are places, venues where we could try to generate some of our integrated understanding.
There's also, have you all heard of the Salish Sea Institute being hosted at Western Washington University? This is a new institute. Ginny Broadhurst is the director or whatever the top title is there. And she has come and talked to the science panel, first about the institute when they were getting started, but also now about a new report that they're going to lead. And it's, well, they were calling it the State of the Salish Sea Report, but the science panel encouraged them to give it a different name just because there's already too many state of the whatevers, and they were urging to focus less on a static sort of assessment and more on the dynamic elements of the system and different areas. So anyway, she was coming looking for ideas on where to focus and things like that, and I think marine mammals in particular being sort of boundary crossers and integrators of the ecosystem, there will likely be some sort of focus there. So anyway, stay tuned, but also maybe look it up. I don't know if they have a newsletter or anything. I just had the privilege of hearing Ginny talk about it at science panel meetings.
Just a little more background on that is that this grew out of the Salish Sea Ecosystem Conference, not the Institute, but the report. And it was thought kind of ridiculous that we're talking about the whole Sailor Sea at the conference, but then we put out these products for Puget Sound or for Strait of Georgia. So it was called, it was supposed to have been actually done for this last conference to have that full report, but it didn't. So this is sort of an outgrowth. And one of, just mentioning the SAOC Ecosystem Conference, is one of the thought patterns among the in a steering committee is to try to develop coordinated sessions at the next conference and start talking about them this year and try to have PSAM sessions at the Ecosystem Conference. So stay tuned for a little more about the coordination, but that should be something that should be in mind.
So I guess I'd like to open it up to anybody who has thoughts on visions on how we might collaborate, either ourselves or linkages with other work groups that are of interest. I guess go ahead.
I mean, I was just going to say for linkages, I said this earlier, the Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force recommendations that you could, you know, there could be linkages right there. You know, what are they working on? What are we working on? Mm-hmm. You know, what are common grounds? You know, maybe a matrix of, you know, a list of, this is what they identified, this is what we know this work is going on here, or whatever. Some linkage to the
Yeah, and on that, the top six work group in PSEMP is definitely focused on a couple of those recommendations, and especially with helping with the contaminants of emerging concern prioritization recommendation. So that's one connection point within PSEMP that's also connected to the Orca Task Force that I know of. And then, of course, the Salmonid work group, I think, would be another key connection. But, you know, you guys should generate these. I can tell you what I think later.
Yeah. I think a matrix or a list would be a nice thing to provide, both to the steering committee and also to the other leads, which is something I could do. This is my short list of other trophic levels that matter to marine mammals that I can think of. I don't know if folks have others that they want to add to this, or a ranking of who would you like to talk to first? Personally, I around the calling issue, I felt that one fear I had is that the public is confused about which salmon the pinnipeds are eating. And I think I haven't talked to Jacques White about the Marine Survival Project, but my understanding, based on past presentations at the SAOC's Ecosystems Conference, is that they're eating both out-migrating smolts and adults of various species. And when I look at their website, at least, it's not clear from the public's perspective what we're talking about anymore. I'm worried that we've lost the resolution of they're eating a certain number of out-migrating smolts, which is probably a problem in certain places, and they're eating adults too, but I'm worried that we could be more clear about which and how much they're eating. What do you, any thoughts on that from the group?
Mm-hmm. I just think...
Hey, can I speak up, Steve? This is John Scordino. I'm wondering, how much do we engage on this one when the task force has this identified as a separate work group? I mean, how much does this group get into where something else will also be doing?
So they have a prey working group. I guess I was thinking more about in terms of the question of whether it's worth calling pinnipeds in Puget Sound, whether we need more clarity on what the Puget Sound pinnipeds are eating, rather than the southern residents.
You know what might be helpful? I think it's getting more clarity on what is the plan for those working groups. And I think as Jerry mentioned earlier, You know, this is sort of a two-year process. It happened very rapidly. People were pulled into these working groups. And there's a need to think, what is the long-term sort of stable framework for continuing these conversations that are going to need to continue happening? And so maybe this is even kind of an invitation to pull in some of those people from that working group to this conversation, but also to get clarity on, are there specific information needs that are a priority now in the near term to help with decisions? And maybe that's a place where this group might be able to also help prioritize or fill those information needs. So just, I do think it's important to raise this question that, sorry, I missed your name on the phone, but
John, who
raised this question is, being clear that we're not duplicating efforts and we're working to complement one another in the system and add value. So
and
I think it's a good point.
One thing I should reiterate, which is Jerry and I have met with Todd Haas, who has his intent was to be here today and will be part of future meetings to try to help us understand what the task force and the work groups have been covering or need help on. So he'll be a resource for us with those sorts of questions too.
Yeah, I was just going to make a comment. You asked about what salmon are seals eating or pinnipeds eating.
Yeah.
And I think the big issue is salmon biology. We've got five different species of salmon. Their biology is all complicated. They're all, for most people, a salmon is a salmon when it's really complicated. So how do you message to the public this really complex salmon biology issue with multiple species so it's simple enough? Because
I would love to see that presentation.
Yeah, and I just think that's I think that's the thing that we struggle with. That, you know, people think salmon are just salmon. They're not. You
yeah.
know, and they're you know, we've got Chinook that have a 6-year life cycle and a coho that has got a 2-year life cycle, and they're all mixed together. And you got chum salmon. Anyway, it's a whole salmon. It's pretty complex for the public to understand how why we struggle with doing ecosystem models and food web models, because they're really when you put the model up there, it's really complex. And how do you simplify that message to the public that everything's interconnected? So I mean, I would just linking the task force work with our tasks, I do think that there were presentations to the task force that I've never seen. There were documents that were brought up. Marine mammal documents are brought up to the task force that I've never seen. So maybe a list of things were presented for the task force for the group to see, the work group to see. Where did they end up? Because if you didn't participate in the process, you don't have a clue to where what they were dealing with, and they were dealing with this complexity in that group.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that, you know, just a comment on the answer that the group came up with, that it's the lack of salmon, is the same answer that we came up with 20 years ago, that they need more salmon. So, I mean, I can understand where, you know, people like Ken are frustrated with the process, because we keep saying, you know, for the last, I've been doing this for 40 years, and we've been trying to recover salmon for 40 years. So, and I think we've got a lot of talk, and where's the action, I think, is what people want. Anyway.
So one clear thing I've heard from Ken before he left the call was that we could coordinate with the Marine Waters Group and get at least the center's population data, which is related to a vital sign, into the Marine Waters report. That seems like an easy goal for the spring. Any other suggestions of, I guess I'll call that a near-term action of the working group, things we could do in this next spring or the next couple of quarters, as opposed to longer-term topics we want to keep thinking about throughout the year.
I think maybe
this is John. This is John. You know, again, some I think might be interesting for the work as a work plan is to identify all current marine mammal research that's going on marine mammals inside Puget Sound, and as you pointed out, to the range to which they extend. For instance, I wasn't aware of what was happening at Fidalgo Island, that there's monitoring going there, and I think there's, you know, university students come and go on, and they have their different projects that could be very interesting, but sometimes they're hard to keep track of all the different projects that are happening and, you know, where they get published and whatnot, and sometimes not published. So I think it would be interesting to have a list of everything that's going on, and so you can kind of reference back to that in the future and know, you know, what are the data sources that are available and who are the curators of those data sources.
So, this is Jerry. Just, I think that's a great idea. It sort of goes back to one of the things we had previously done in this group and all the work groups was to create an inventory of ongoing monitoring programs, monitoring assessment programs. And we did that, and then we analyzed that to do a gap analysis of where we thought there were missing things. But that's all old and outdated and probably not as comprehensive as to what you're looking for, which would be more almost toward a database. And I think, that's a great idea. I was thinking along the lines maybe we would want to make a product of something like the state of knowledge for Salish Sea. Just what do we know without trying to, you know, do full assessments. When there is information for assessment, we can do that and we can identify what we know. And that is essentially a little more in-depth than a plain inventory of monitoring. And it integrates some programs, but it, it's not as comprehensive as a, as like the state of the sound type of analyses. It would be really useful for anybody that's trying to do additional programs from the task force to the discussions on culling to whatever else is there, and it would help us make an argument for the missing research that we would need to be able to do an appropriate assessment. I don't know if that would be a 2019 product or a 2020 product, but it's just a concept. We have identified that products are needed. This is what our consumers of our information want, is something fairly straightforward and concise. So I think it would be a good idea to look at some type of products along those lines.
I agree with that. This is Cindy Elliser. And also, because there's been a lot of talk in the science community recently about, you know, science communication to non-scientists and stuff, and like, and it goes with what you guys, everyone was talking about earlier about being able to, you know, people are not understanding exactly what's going on, it's complicated. So, like, is there a way to, on that we could have something where, you know, it's a small snippet that people from the work group, they've done some research and they're putting it out in scientific publication, but have an area where we write a little synopsis that's a little bit more straightforward for that people can just, you know, anybody can just go and read, like, on the website that kind of explains, hey, this is what happened, this is what's happening now, and this is what we found out in a way that everybody can understand, and so it reaches more people.
Question for you, Jerry, is were you thinking of a state of knowledge as something that would cover all species, specific species, or emerging topics, or?
I'd like to see, if nothing else, just simply, you know, what knowledge we have on the status and distribution of all the marine mammals of Puget Sound, Salish Sea, U.S. portion of Salish Sea that we could have. It would be great if we could incorporate more, you know, for the entire Salish Sea. But that, anyway, yeah, I mean, the idea is not to get too ambitious, yeah. You know, that we all know what the pretty much what the knowledge is for the species we work with or the sources for them, and to just sort of compile it into a very short document, I think would be really useful to the people outside of the field sphere, that the managers and things, and ourselves, of course. But I'm looking at small scale rather than the larger major reference document.
I might add a maybe friendly, hopefully friendly amendment to that. Just I think there's a lot of different approaches to communication. I think from what Cindy was saying, which I definitely, I was sitting here nodding, Cindy, like, yes, things that make it more accessible, maybe small synopses that are directly communicating. But I think the key here in any of this, or making even any decisions about what the group will focus on, because any of these things, it's a lot of work, particularly for a group like this that's coming together from dispersed places, but is to be really clear about the objective and the audience. And that's something we're going to be working on, a communications plan for PSEMP, and hopefully with this hopefully new money and the new biennium funding, get funding to support work group products and development and more synopses and things like this as well. But just even from, hearing what our sort of PSEMP customers had to say when we did interviews last summer and things like that, there's sort of different levels of information needs for different purposes. And so I think, like, the Marine Waters Report is on one end of the spectrum. I actually find it fairly dense. I think it's a great reference for the people who are in the scientific community who are already fairly familiar with what's going on. But to expect it to really reach maybe decision makers or other folks, there's kind of a need for another layer that's more brief, more graphic, and sort of really helping make those connections a lot more plain and explicit. So I think that's, I've been hearing a lot of references to the general public here today. That has not been our main audience at the partnership, but maybe for this group, that is your main audience. But I think this being sort of the first meeting in a long time of this group, there's still a need to maybe have an in-depth conversation even about refining who's the audience, what do you want to achieve, where to focus, and maybe there's a few different things that necessitate completely different approaches or reports or documents or webinars or workshops or whatever kind of approach. So I don't think that there's a one-size-fits-all here.
Okay, well, it seems like the easy thing is to start with what we've already done, and I think Ken is able to do that. So this gives me a good idea of some ongoing discussions we can have about the audience and the venues. I have some of my own ideas about, my feeling is that a nice way to build a state of knowledge would be to start with the encyclopedia and try to take pieces of it that some subcommittees or subsections of us feel are our favorite species, and sort of divide up the work a little bit. Or the goal might be to annually update the Encyclopedia of Puget Sound article on that species and have that be then categorized as part of a state of the Salish Sea marine mammals. So I think there'll probably be many ways to integrate it, but the important thing is to take the most recent results and the particularly new monitoring data that we managed to get and more quickly get it into the something like the Puget Sound encyclopedia, so that the public and policymakers can see and digest it quickly.
Yeah, I think that's a good move too. Maybe even for future iterations of this Marine Waters Report, for instance, might be to move it online and make it more readily updatable. And it's a pretty onerous process, and it comes out pretty far after the data was collected. And so, anyway, I think it's a great example, but also there's a lot of room for. I mean, this, you guys can learn from, like, oh, how would you do it differently? And, yeah, use the tools like the encyclopedia. And, yeah, all good ideas.
So we have 10 minutes left. Any other?
Scott?
Sure.
This is Pete. I didn't have a chance to hold on just a second. Can you still hear me?
You've got an echo, Pete, but we can hear you.
landscape. My phone system.
A lot of trouble.
Yeah.
I think we might have just lost Pete. I think I'll be able to facilitate a conversation of what other products we might plan on trying to generate in 2019 via email. The last thing I wanted to get folks' input on is if anyone has strong opinions about how often we would like to meet, and if you're interested in in-person meetings, whether people have particular preferences geographically, and also whether this felt like a reasonable amount of time or whether you want more or less in future meetings.
This is John. I thought it was a good amount of time.
I agree. This is Aileen. I like it being half a day rather than encompassing lunch.
Okay. Is that Pete? Are you back?
Yes, it is.
Welcome.
Am I back to you with or without the echo? I think I hear the echo.
Well, it sounds pretty good to us. Go ahead, Pete.
Okay. There are two things that I wanted to mention. Maybe they were mentioned while I was trying to straighten out my communication devices here, but there's the group that I alluded to earlier, NOAA, National Marine Mammal Foundation, and the one I forgot was CDOC. Those three organizations have come together and have created a system whereby a matrix involving the health assessment of each individual southern resident killer whale will be pulled together in one site. Probably Lynn or Brad. Lynn probably would have mentioned that had she been here. So if that hasn't been mentioned, that's something that perhaps I can help link our databases up with. The other is the Marine Advisory Committee, which is a part of the Puget Sound Partnership. The Kwala Marine Advisory Committee is going to have a ORCA forum, most likely May 10, and tied in with the science program up here May 11th. I think probably the other Marine Advisory Committees are doing likewise. I see that you coordinate with only one of the Marine Advisory Committees. I think an effort to tie in with those as a specific line item would be important. I know that the Clallam MAC has a internship program where we have anywhere from 5 to 7 internships a year. I don't know if the other ones are like that or not. Probably somebody there does. But there is I think, a terrific forum for public education. In fact, that's what the mission of ours is to educate the public, as was mentioned earlier, in a language that the public can can understand.
Great. Thanks, Pete. Those are good suggestions. We just have a few minutes left. I wanted to thank everybody who's never attended one of these for participating today, as well as the old guard. I feel like we have a lot of information to offer, and I'm excited that there's some new observational efforts, and I think there's more that we'll discover if we keep talking. I'm going to propose that we meet quarterly. I think it will, except for in the summer, so we can focus on monitoring during the summer, but have a chance in the fall to begin the process of thinking about what happened so that we can report on it in the winter and then share that with the public in the spring. Any other closing closing thoughts from anyone?
One thought. I just wanted to thank Scott for taking the lead on this and bringing forward the group and seeming to create pretty dynamic discussions and meeting. And look forward to the future. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Well, I will draft a plan based on what I've heard today. And I will circulate that so that you all can chime in electronically. But in the short term, we'll provide that draft as well as the report on our activities over the last couple of years. I think I'll just summarize where we've been as the task force has formed. And I guess we'll look forward to making a contribution to the Marine Waters report this year, too. Thank you all.
Thank you, Scott. Good job. Thank you, Scott. Thank you. Bye. Bye.
That's a pretty amazing system. Thank you for making it available.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And I should have, again, thanked the...
Yeah, I just wanted... I was going to say, the one outcome I would like is when the next one of these things comes out, when you look, turn to the marine mammal section, there's something in there about marine mammals.
That's a good goal.
I think that's an attainable goal for the next one.
Well, I mean, again, there's stuff that we talked about today that could have been in here, and nobody ever talked to me about updating this.
It's just a matter of who's already in the loop, I think.
It stuck to what the Marine Waters was doing, which was, physical, biological, and chemical oceanography. I mean, that's what the report initially was. Then we talked about, well, maybe we should expand it into the larger biologics. We put birds and marine mammals in there. And a lot of the marine mammals was, we did put a call out, and the only one that responded was Aileen. She had a couple ones on harbor porpoise. And there were others on marine birds. And that was essentially, it, because we had made people aware that this was available, but nobody came forward.
And I heard about it in spring of 2017, because I am pretty close. I was trained as an oceanographer, so I had been watching them, but I failed to reach out to people like you who would have been able to make a contribution.
Lack of response, but then also, not intentionally being comprehensive about it. Because it's not meant to be a whole... I think it's been evolving. And then without additional... and then it's become a bigger and bigger burden to the consistently small group of editors that are just from that group. Anyway, there are layers and layers of history with that that I'm slowly getting up to speed on.
The other thing I think we need to work on is there's actually a lot of discussion today, but I think in the past meetings a lot of silence. So having presentations it's not leaving it up to the group to talk about things, because maybe people don't want to.
Scott's a pretty strong facilitator, and you had an excellent agenda and
straw
things for people to react to. I'm sorry, I feel like I spoke up too much. I think it was good. Is it okay?
I didn't speak up too much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel like that in my role, that I should let the group drive things, but then at the same time I also feel compelled to introduce the tidbits, and I'm a natural connection maker, which is why I think I'm in this job.
Yeah.
But so just in the future, send me a signal or a chat, maybe take a step back, Jen, and I won't take offense.
I think it was good today, and honestly, I know that some members sort of want a mandate, and that's probably why it's been a little silent recently.
Mm.
So having more communication saying, the science panel really thinks this is important, I think that'll help motivate people. And
that's good to hear, too, because I hear, just since coming in and trying to be sensitive to this, and I think there's been historical baggage and tension and people